Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you guys once again for joining in and listening to today's show. We have Kate Sewoba joining us. She's the creator of YourCourageousLife.com, director of Courageous Living, and the coach certification of TribeCLCC.com. All this information will be on my website. As always, we're going to talk about courage. How to accept your fears, release the past, live your most courageous life. A lot of people want to do things, they want to step forward, they want to live a more authentic life. But Kate will talk to us about courage, how courage plays a very large role in that experience. She lays it out in incredible detail. She has a four-part process that she believes will help you step into the life that feels right for you. She's been featured in Mind Body Green, Entrepreneur, USA Today, Forbes, and many, many, many others I could keep listing. She was awesome. I hope you liked today's show. I learned a lot. I really enjoyed myself. And as always, thanks for listening. Come over to lauraco.com and check out the podcast. Listen in there. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Kate Sewoba, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad I didn't butcher your name. You helped coach me on that right before we jumped on.
I get asked a lot. Like I said, it's totally fine. It's totally fine.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here. And for everybody listening, we're going to deep dive into some topics that I think are applicable to all of your lives. Fear, courage, you know, all the stuff it takes to get out there and doing things that are meaningful. But before we do, I wanted to have you take us back a little bit. It's so specific to be talking about courage and fear. What got you interested in this? What, tell us a little more about your story and what led to this work. And we'll talk about your book and everything in a few.
Well, I think that, you know, I grew up with these parents who were radically different in disposition from one another. And you know, they got divorced when I was seven. And I just feel like there were a lot of experiences I'd had that were difficult. And I've always wondered, you know, are some people more predisposed to respond to life in some ways than others? And I think that's probably true. And then I think some of it's engineered. You know, I don't know. All I know is that my responses to life, initially at least, when I was afraid or when I was challenged, were get really defended, put up the armor, get really like, I'm not afraid. I'm going to, you know, white knuckle my way through. I'm going to push through. I'm not going to get vulnerable. I'm not going to wallow. I'm going to, you know, push, 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 push. And I mean, I think that there's light and dark to everything. And that's a shadow side of actually, you know, very helpful skill, which is the ability to trust that if you push through something, you will get some kind of a gift. In my case, it was overkill. And so a lot of my journey's been about softening and finding the courage that is in softness. And I would say that I started to really learn that journey, gosh, about a little more than a decade ago. I had done this thing that to me had been very hard. I was living on a very low salary in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'd managed to save up enough money and take a break from my salary job to go to Italy for a summer. And I was in Italy, and it was, for me, it was a big risk. It was a financial risk. It was also what if I go to Italy and I'm the one person in the history of the world who like goes to Italy and doesn't think it's fun, you know, I had all kinds of fears. And then I ended up having a great time. And what shifted for me that had me then look back on all these experiences of how I'd been handling fear and looking at it and kind of going, oh, what's going on here? Is that I posted something on social media about having a great time, and then the universe's great gift to me. Somebody said something wet blankety about, well, not everybody can go to Italy. And the gift was that the person who said this to me was someone who I knew had a lot more money than I did and who had paid vacation. And something clicked in that moment where I went, oh, okay. All right. So there's just a difference here going on. I made a choice, and I, you know, in fact, have less risk than this person would having made the same choice. And I was willing to just be in the muck of the fear and the of the fear and the discomfort and the sometimes insomnia of the fear. And I started then looking at all these experiences of my life in hindsight and going, oh, that's what I was doing there. That's what I was doing there. That's what I was doing there. It was this willingness to be in the discomfort. So at that point, I just got more interested in how everybody was responding to everything. And it started to really inform, you know, how I was as a coach. And I just started noticing a lot more in life, like what someone's tolerance and their willingness to be in the discomfort. And how can we expand that? You know, because somebody's not a bad person just because they have a low tolerance for that discomfort. They're just a person who, you know, probably just needs more help with a skill set. So that is like the shorter version of a story that included a lot of, you know, two steps forward and one step back and making mistakes and messing it all up and then having to start over and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. And you brought up a couple things that I just want to touch on for a moment, because I think for those people listening, it's sort of these turns of phrases and they seem kind of straightforward, but they're kind of deep and meaningful and difficult. And when you talk about the sitting in the muck of fear and the insomnia and the willingness to sit in the discomfort and then looking for the gift, right? Isn't there also a perspective there of there's a meaning to it all, or there's gratitude behind all of it? How do you think about the combination of there's a gift when I sit through a discomfort, right? Like most people wouldn't tie those things together.
Mm. Well, at the time that I'm talking about, where I was really, I think of it as like white knuckling my way through fear, I wasn't thinking about a gift. It was just, if I don't hustle my way through this, I won't survive. Like there was some self-conception that didn't feel like I would survive, you know? And then the meaning, I think, shifted because of the then reevaluating in hindsight. It was like, oh, okay, look at, instead of it being, what if things aren't okay? I got to hustle through, I got to white knuckle through, because what if things aren't okay? Reviewing in hindsight became, look how many times it turned out okay. Look how many times I found my way to the gift. And so, I mean, I think it's a really helpful, you know, exercise for any of us to undertake when we struggle with fear, to start going, how many times did you make it through? We've all been rejected, for instance. We've all had breakups. Very rare is it the first person you ever fall in love with is the person you end up marrying and having a great life with. So we've all, you know, done that. So the question is, do you have some breakups and go, there's no one in the world for me? Or do you have some breakups and then go, you know what? After each of these breakups, somehow I found my way to feeling okay enough again to try to love again. And you can do this with money. You can do this with business. You can do this with looking at politics and justice and going, you know, God, you know, two steps backwards, a million steps backwards, it feels like lately. But you know what? Like, what do I want to anchor towards? Do I want to anchor towards optimism, or do I want to anchor towards pessimism? And I say that in a very practical way, not a like spiritual bypass, just look for the light, just throw some glitter on it, but in a very practical, self-preserving way. How do I move out of the catastrophizing that fear can bring and then go, what is it that I'm actually trying to move into here?
Yeah. And, you know, I joke, like, what were you deeply afraid of April of 2004, 2005? Right? Like, you can't remember, right? But at the time, it feels paralyzing. And yet, it's like a year later, we can't remember what it was that we were stressed or worried or fearful of. But at the time, it's so meaningful. So I think it's so important to think about it in those terms. You did make it through. You're still standing. You're still breathing, right? Like, and what do we even mean when we have that sensation that we're not going to make it through? I mean, it's not going to kill us, right? So yeah. So white knuckling versus feeling it, sitting with the discomfort. We're taught to white knuckle, right? It's man up, suck it up, push it down. My book, Emotional Obesity, right? Like I'm on the same page with you. We just stuff this stuff down and try to deal, but it doesn't work. It bubbles up and eventually catches up to us, but we don't want to feel it because it's so, as you already mentioned, uncomfortable. So for people listening, probably most of them have some fear in their life, if not a lot. The first thought is, why would I want to sit with that feeling? It's terrible. I just want to move through that as fast. I want to be busy. I want to go have fun. I don't want to sit with a bad feeling. Why do it? And then what are some strategies to make it more comfortable and something that doesn't feel like it's going to consume you?
well, why do it if somebody really is hearing this and going, why would I want to like face this stuff? Like, then okay, if it's a life strategy that works for you, okay. You know, it wasn't working for me. I was deeply depressed. I was deeply irritated all the time, like angry all the time, judging all the time. I think that Brené Brown really nailed it. I mean, the whole self-help community needs to like do some justice to Dr. Brené Brown, because there's all this personal growth stuff that like we've been saying, those of us who have been doing this work for a while, and then she went out and researched it and quantified it. And we're like, yes, thank you. It's not just a woo-woo theory, but you know, she says, and this is based in research, that you can't selectively shut down emotion. If you shut down your fear, you're shutting down your confidence. If you shut down your sadness, you're shutting down your joy. Like it just doesn't work that way. If it's working for someone to ignore things as a life strategy, then I mean, I'm not interested in really telling anyone how to do life. I'm only sharing my experience. And then the other thing I would say too is that there's a way in which for a while, I think the pattern can almost mirror like using substances. It's like, well, I don't want to feel those feelings. Let me go out and party. Let me just go out and, you know, and that's something even I've looked at in my own life. Like there was a period of my own life that was particularly stressful. And it was like one night my husband and I were like, let's get a bottle of wine. And then like the next night it was like, that was really fun. Let's get another bottle of wine. And then before we knew it, we were kind of like, God, we've had a bottle of wine like every, you know, every night for a month. And it's like, eh, no big deal. And then before you know it, it's like, oh, this is actually feeling like something that I don't feel like I'm an alcoholic, but something that I didn't feel like, it just become this default strategy. And then I find myself going, wait, hold on, what did I do before we were getting a bottle of wine every night? That's the vein I put it into. So, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar for sure. If someone has the ability to just not really deal with it and live life and they feel good and they feel fulfilled, I'm like, rock on. Otherwise, I'd say the strategy of avoiding really will catch up with you. And that ends up being something I talk about in the Courage Habit, that the predominant ways that we want to deal with our fear are to avoid it, to please it, or to attack it. So we either avoid it and try not to feel it or numb out to it. We try to please it, which is kind of like a perfectionistic pattern of, if I can just do life right or be in control, then my fear won't get activated.
Right.
Or we try to attack it and we go, you know, that's the internet memes about kicking fear's ass and all that good stuff, telling your fear to F off. And
yeah,
again, in the short term, will these strategies work? Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
So
but in the long term, no.
If those don't work, what are a couple ways that do work?
All right. So I'll get into like some of the fun courage habity stuff then.
Habity.
Habity. I know. Here we go. Inventing words.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, so I was not originally interested in habit formation. And then I started to do some research on habit formation a couple of years ago. And it like opened up a whole thing where I was like, oh my gosh, habit formation, the model of how science understands habit formation to work in the brain completely fits with a model that I have been doing for a while of how we practice courage, myself and a lot of people, which is you don't get rid of fear. You feel afraid and you have a different response to that fear than just, you know, avoiding, pleasing, or attacking. So in that vein, I began looking at, okay, so what are the most common fear patterns? And then what's research saying are the most common or effective, rather, behavioral responses that we can develop when we feel those fear patterns or when we see them at work in our lives. So habit formation works in the brain on this cue, routine, reward loop. So cue is you feel afraid. Routine is you either go into a fear pattern or a courage-based habit. And reward is feeling less stress. And with fear-based patterns, if that's the routine you go into, the reward is temporary and shorter lived. And courage-based habits, if that's the routine you go into, you're going to have a longer-term reward. You're asking me about, like, what are these things that we can do? And the research really pointed to four specific behavioral responses. And you can do one of them, but it's really powerful if you do all of them. And they are to access the body, to listen to your fear, but without getting attached to what it says, reframing limiting stories, and reaching out and creating community. And I can talk about what all of those are and hash them out a little bit. But really, I think that they all work together in a very process-based way. But like I said, if you want to do just one of them, that is actually really helpful too. What's most important is that you don't just let your fear-based patterns run as a routine on autopilot, because whenever you practice a fear-based routine, when you feel fear, you go into a fear routine, you get that short-term reward, that just strengthens that habit pattern in the brain. Whereas when you feel fear and move into a courage-based behavior instead, that ends up strengthening that habit.
And one thing I want to just really highlight here that I hope everybody listening takes away is we don't want to get rid of it. We can't get rid of it, right? Mm. Like, we are designed to have fear. And there are times, thank the Lord, right, that we have it, because you're walking down the street, you have that weird feeling that something is off. We're designed to have some primal sense of situations that are actually not okay. And so it's very important to have fear. And in distinguishing between that and, say, when I started my blog post, I had a lot of fear about sending out the first one. I'm not going to die from sending out a blog post, right? Like, I'm not actually in danger, but we're designed for this. So I think it's really important to just pause on that. We don't want to get rid of it. As you said, we can't get rid of it. It's how we're designed, and it's really, really helpful. I mean, have you ever been somewhere where you're walking and you just have a sense there's a car coming, or there's, right? Like, we have that little innate side of us that fear triggers, and it can really save us from very dangerous situations.
Well, I love that you bring up self-preservation, because in my mind, especially along the lines of we don't get rid of fear, I see fear as a wound. It's a wounded part of who we are. And its only interest is in not having to live through further wounding. So, you know, when your fear tells you you're not enough, that's also a self-preservation instinct. It's not one that's ultimately functional the way paying attention to your instincts if you might be in danger walking around outside is, but it is a self-preservation instinct, because if you feel like you're not enough and your fear starts telling you you're not enough, you're not enough, you're not enough, and then you don't do the thing that might subject you to criticism, the fear is really concerned that you're going to go over some kind of an edge and really lose your sense of identity, really lose sense of who you are. And it's, you know, most of us can tell with a little bit of looking that this is not a rational fear, that nobody, as you said, you know, nobody's going to die. But at the same time, there's a very real sense in which, I think, emotional or psychological level, we're trying to preserve whatever sense of self we can. And that's really important to know, that fear is not the enemy. It's just got, like, you know, some short circuits around trying to jump in there to protect.
Yeah. I always say it's my overprotective bodyguard, right? Like, sometimes it's just not needed as much. So talk to me about these four things, because I do think they're just spot on and easy to say, but harder to practice. And so I'd love to walk through for the listeners, you know, accessing your body. You're in a deep state of fear. You want to send out that first blog post. You want to leave your job and start a business. You think you're in a marriage that you need to get out of, you know, fear's kicking in and it's really getting to you, or something smaller. You just feel fear on a date, right? So it doesn't matter the size, but accessing your body, why that is a first step. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, so fear isn't logical, right? It's primal. That's why it's so important. The fear sensations that you feel are going to override logic 9 times out of 10. And even I think when we try to default to logic as a strategy, really that's just a way of trying to get the fear sensations to die down. So really it's like using logic to try to get yourself to access the body and chill out, which is, you know, one way of doing it. But again, it tends to be about numbing out or overriding, and we want to avoid that. So accessing the body is all about If fear starts in the body, we got to deal with it in the body. And that can look like anything. The very much touted meditation is one option, you know, getting present to what you feel, but following the breath instead of following some kind of a spiral. There's ample research showing that mindfulness is incredibly beneficial, but there are other things you can do. Some of my favorites include some of which I actually practiced. In fact, just before getting on the call today, crying, like conscious crying, like taking some time and just like noticing that you have some emotion pent up and just taking some time to cry, dancing it out. Any kind of exercise that you are consciously using as catharsis. So if you're just going, you're exercising, that's a little bit different. But if you're going, you're like, all right, like I need to run and like I need to actually get something out here, you know, cathartic, you know, like kind of a, you know, type of run.
Yeah.
That can be really helpful. Screaming into a towel can be really helpful. I think that little kids show us a lot, and I'm the mother of a small child. So I just go, you know, no, I don't think that people need to be throwing temper tantrums at the grocery store when the product that they want is out. But at the same time, on a deeper level, when you're scared of going out on that date, you make sense. Actually, there's a reason you're scared of going out on that date. So just like, it sounds nuts. I get it. But take some time to consciously sit down and cry it out for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or whatever it is that works for you. My son, I have a 12-year-old. He likes to punch a pillow every once in a while. Or like, you know, it just like, I so agree with you. Kids do this, which means we all did it. So mm-hmm. We all know how, right? And we all had our style. And just moving it through. It's energy, right? We want to move the energy. We want to move it. It's stuck. And so it gets stuck. And then the more stuck it gets, the more we think, the heavier it gets, right? And then it becomes intolerable at some point and you're up all night and that whole thing kicks in. So listen to the fear. So I scream it out or I jog it out or cry it out, what have you, and then tune in, listen. What does that look like? What do you suggest?
So that looks like noticing what the fear is saying, but without believing that it's true. And the example, and I know some people are like, well, yeah, sure. I'll just flip that light switch over there. That'll be easy. You know, it's like, no, I get it. But it is something that, you know, with anything that becomes a habit, it's harder at first and then it gets easier. And so the way that I like to frame this for people would be like, if you were walking down the street and a drunk guy was nearby and he started saying, you have rainbow hair, you have rainbow hair, you know, like you'd hear his actual words, you would know that like, you don't want to listen to what he's saying. You might do something self-preserving, like move out of his general vicinity, and you wouldn't believe what the fear, what that person, that drunk person is saying. So it's the same thing with your fear. It's like, look, your fear is going to tell you you're not enough, you're not enough, you're not enough. Well, you listen to it. Like, I hear you saying that I'm not enough. And then it's like boundaries, because like, I know that if I was walking around and some drunk guy was saying something to me, if he was really, you know, trying to be in my space, it would just be this thing of like putting up my hand and going, you need to stop. Like, this actually isn't okay with me.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And it's so funny because it's in your head. So you believe it because it's you, and then it sounds like you. It uses your voice, right? It uses the cadence, the tone, the sound. So it's much harder to say, well, I'm not going to trust that, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it's true just because it's living within you, right? So what I'm hearing you say is externalizing it, thinking about it as if it's else, right? Instead of one and the same with yourself.
Well, with these voices, they often mirror whatever fear pattern we're most likely to be hooked by. So earlier I mentioned that there's a cue, routine, reward, and you can feel the cue of fear and go into a fear pattern, or you can feel the cue of fear and go into a courage-based behavior. And there are these four predominant fear patterns that people tend to get stuck in, and they are perfectionism, people-pleasing or martyrdom, pessimism, or self-sabotage. So usually this voice of fear, you know, if perfectionism is the fear pattern I most get stuck in, that voice of fear that's going to come up is probably going to be telling me how I should be doing it better. And if the fear pattern that I'm most likely to get stuck in is pessimism, which is more that like wet blankety, womp womp, it never works out, you know, stuff, then that's most likely what my critic is going to sound like, my internalized voice of fear. You know, if people pleasing and martyrdom is my predominant pattern, we all do all of these to some degree, but usually one hooks us more than the others. And if people pleasing and martyrdom is my predominant pattern, then I'm probably going to be worried that I'm selfish if I say what I need to say or speak my truth or go after what I want, even if it means I might have to say no to someone else. And self-sabotage is all about like procrastination and avoidance. And, you know, so my critic is probably going to say something if I'm in self-sabotage mode, like, oh, you know, put that off for right now. You don't need to deal with that right now. And then, you know, you miss the deadline and lose the opportunity, which is classic self-sabotage kind of move. So however your fear is showing up, it's probably going to mirror your fear pattern. So the idea is that if you know what your fear pattern is, it gives you an extra little edge, like, ah, oh, okay, okay, okay. I know what this is. I know what the voice of pessimism sounds like. I've taken the time to understand what martyrdom sounds like. And when you take the time to really understand that fear pattern and identify which one really hooks you the most often, it gives you a really powerful tool for being able to listen without attachment and go, ah, there's my fear again. Gotcha. I understand.
And then to reframe it, right, is the next step.
Absolutely. Yeah. And reframing limiting stories, I like to be careful to say, is not reciting positive affirmations. This is a therapeutic approach that's validated in cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy. And there's research showing that actually taking time for cognitive reframing is vitally important, that people who do it regularly have higher self-esteem. So we're not talking about if you feel like you're enough, you're not enough, and that's what's keeping you from, I don't know, going after your dream job. We're not talking about you sitting around and reciting positive affirmations and going, I'm the best one for the job. In fact, no one else has ever been as good as me, and I'm better than everybody in the world. And I'm, you know, like no one's saying that. What we're talking about with reframing is when your critic says, you're not enough, there's no point. I know this voice. This is a hybrid of pessimism and perfectionism. Okay, reframe limiting stories. Whew, all right. So, you know what? I don't know yet if I'm enough. I'm willing to try. So it's not going wildly optimistic. It's going, what's like the next little lily pad or the next rung on the ladder that I can reach for? And then when I feel comfortable with going, I'm willing to try, then maybe I can get comfortable with, I'm willing to try as many times as it takes. I'm willing to fail. And then maybe I can get comfortable with, I'm someone who knows how to fail. I've failed before. Interesting. I'm alive. I'm okay. And then it can be, you know what, next time I do this, I'm going to reach out and I'm going to ask for more help, or I'm going to work a little harder the night before to really make sure I get this proposal exactly the way I want it, or I'm going to, you know, there are all these sorts of strategies mentally that you start to employ when you go, okay, like there's a limitation I'm placing around the lens I put on the world, and I'm reframing it into, here's what I'd like to actually be putting my attention on. And that actually loops back to, you know, what we were talking about towards the top of the call about, you know, going, what do I want my anchor to be? Do I want it to be, oh God, this horrible thing could happen if I take this risk? Or do I want it to be, how many times have I risked and somehow it turned out okay?
Yep, absolutely. And that tiny difference in the way you frame a sentence can change your entire life. And so the last step is community. Yeah. Talk to me about that.
So I tell this story in the book about how I had been doing work on all this courage and fear, all this wonderful personal growth stuff. And I launched my first ever group coaching course. This was like a very long time ago, almost 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. And I launched this course and I had one person ask for a refund, and then a couple of people didn't participate the way I had thought they would. And I just went into like total, I mean, perfectionism is my dominant fear pattern. I was totally like, oh my God, I've failed. This is so embarrassing. And I didn't really talk to anybody about it. And then my friend McCabe came and visited San Francisco. And we were walking around, taking pictures. She's taught a bunch of courses. She goes, how'd it go? And I was like, okay, here's what happened. And then she starts going, wait a second, hold on, what? One person asked for a refund? How many people did you have enrolled? And I'm like, 60. She's like, let me get this straight. Like, let me get this straight, Kate. So basically, my point being with reaching out and creating community is that nobody's perfect. Nobody can do this fear, courage, life, human stuff on their own. You're gonna have blind spots. So you need your community. Like, you need to reach out and create community, because fear really thrives in isolation. Like, the worst time for fear for me is always if I wake up at 3 a.m. and I'm nervous about something, and then I, you know, it's like I can't get to sleep. And I mean, I'm not going to call anybody at 3 a.m. most of the time. So, you know, it's being alone with fear that makes it the most painful. So you've got to find those people who are big into practicing courage. That doesn't have to look like friendships. I mean, I think hiring a coach, somebody who's, you know, interested in working with you, you know, is that's one of the ways you create community. Some of my community are professionals. Reaching out, creating community, and really letting yourself be seen. And what is interesting is that when there's actually research that shows that people are more successful at behavioral change when they do it within the context of community instead of on their own. And that's exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Well, Kate, so much information. I'm sure everybody listening is just taking notes. If they want more information, they want to hear more, yourcourageouslife.com. The book is The Courage Habit, How to Accept Your Fears, Release the Past, and Live Your Courageous Life. Anywhere else that they can find you, or anything else you want to shout out real quick to the audience?
I am part of the Courageous Living Coach certification at Tribe CLCC, and just about everywhere on social media, you can find me on as Kate Courageous.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of this valuable information.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great and fun.